Well, good morning and welcome to another episode of Inside UMiami Medicine. I'm Owen Ford, the Dean and Chief Academic Officer of the University of Miami Leonard M. Miller School of Medicine, and I'm delighted to be your host. Today, we have an absolutely exciting program. We welcome to the studio Dr. Dalton Dietrich. He's a tenured professor of neurosurgery. He holds a Kinetics Concept Distinguished Chair in Neurosurgery, and he's the Senior Associate Dean for Discovery Science. As if this is not enough, he's also the co-director of the Institute for Neural Engineering and the scientific director of the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis. But more importantly, Dr. Dietrich is a foremost expert on traumatic and spinal cord injury. That has been the focus of his life's work. His work focuses on approaches to minimize the adverse sequelae associated with traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury. He does so by looking at how to disrupt the ensuing inflammatory cascade that contributes to cell death and exacerbates the problem or disease progression after spinal cord or traumatic brain injury. Specifically, Dr. Dietrich is looking at the role of inflammasomes in exacerbating cell death after injury and the cause and the use of therapeutic hypothermia to attenuate the inflammatory response and respond to cell and minimize cell death. So a whole lot to actually digest, a lot of great topics to cover, and we are going to do our best to do so in the next 30 minutes or so. But we may have to go into a second topic, but let's start with it. But before we get into the substance of these exciting topics, tell the audience a little bit about your background and how you became the scientific director of Miami Project.
Very good. Well, first, thank you very much, Dean Ford, for the invitation. Been looking forward to talking to you about the research. It's been a long and winding road, let's just say. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and my lifelong passion was to become an architect. I actually started thinking about, you know, going to college and become an architect and that type of training. But when I got to the Virginia Tech, where I went to college, I very quickly decided I really wanted to go into medicine. And my roommate was a dental student, and he actually convinced me that I should go to dental school. And of course, the roommate across the hall was also going to dental school. So I thought about that for a couple of years and took all the courses and things like that, and then decided I didn't want to go to dental school, and maybe I should go to medical school. So when I graduated from college, I worked with a pathologist and decided to try to figure out if I would really enjoy being a clinician. And that pathologist really pushed me into direction of thinking about graduate school. And so I went to a graduate school at the Medical College of Virginia. And I was very fortunate in the Department of Anatomy to work with Dr. John Pawlischak, who is one of the foremost researchers in the area of traumatic brain injury and diffuse axonal injury, one of the hallmarks of TBI. There I learned team science because my PhD work was with a group of neurosurgeons. So very quickly, I realized that team science was the way to go. Good basic research, but always thinking about what your research would do in terms of the clinical problem. So I had a fantastic time and learned how to collaborate with large groups in different disciplines. At that point, I decided that I'd learned to become an anatomist. I knew a lot about gross anatomy and hip neuroanatomy and embryology, all the types of things that you learn when you're an anatomist. And it occurred to me that I really needed to think about other disciplines instead of anatomy. So I went to Washington University, one of the best departments of pharmacology in the nation, and worked with Dr. Oliver Lowry. He was a very famous protein chemist. And there, I subsequently started a team science project as well with a colleague, Dr. Tom Woolsey, and he discovered in a summer project the whisker barrel circuit of a rat, and that every whisker on a rat, three synapses away, activates a group of neurons in the primary somatosensory cortex. And we together showed for the first time that the brain was capable of metabolic plasticity. And that really turned me on, that the brain was not concrete. The brain was actually somewhat flexible in terms of its peripheral input to the to its sensory organs.
So it could repair itself? Is that what?
So we thought maybe this was an opportunity to repair itself. And so that allowed me to do a lot of really good research and learn a little bit more about receptors, ligands, interactions, cell signaling cascades, all the things that I had not learned in graduate school in anatomy.
And what's beautiful by this is that this provided the foundation for everything you've been doing ever since.
It really did. The light bulb came on and I said, you know, the sky's the limit in what I can use this new information for and what types of experiments I could do. So one day, Dr. Lowry comes into my lab, and it wasn't my lab. I actually had a bench, you know, a bench about this big where I ate lunch, did my research and wrote my papers. And he said, Dalton, there's someone calling you from Miami that wants to offer you a job, I think. And I said, Dr. Lowry, do I need a job? And he goes, yes, you need a job. So basically, I picked the phone up, and it was Dr. Myron Ginsberg. He's a neurologist here at the University of Miami, and he led with Cerebral Vascular Disease Research Center. And so therefore, I came and really fell in love with the university in 1981. So I've been here a few years. Then that's how I really started doing my research in stroke and traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury.
So let's talk a little bit about it. Well, so what drew you to traumatic brain injury? I know you referred to a TBI for my audience just to make sure they understand traumatic brain injury. So traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, what was the magnet? What drew you to that? And understanding that ultimately you used to devote your life to understanding how to repair the damage caused by that.
Well, it's an interesting injury. It affects many different types of mechanisms of secondary injury.
And let me interrupt for a second. Tell us a little bit about the most common causes of traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury.
Motor vehicle accidents is one of the major large ones. Violence right now is on the rise. Falls and things of this nature. And, you know, we try in terms of preventing trauma. We have a lot of nice programs and bicycle safety and crossing streets and things like that. But it's really interesting. It used to be in terms of traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injury that it would be the young males, basically. They're out doing a lot of crazy things, if you will, and things of this nature. But now we have actually three peaks in terms of TBI and spinal cord injury. This very young age, immediate age, about 45 years of age. But now we have this growing other peak that's about 65 and older.
So is that
for falls? A lot of people that when they're, you know, aging, they actually lose balance and falls. In fact, a friend of mine just did that. So I think the reason I was attracted to the area of neurotrauma, if you will, was that it's a worldwide problem. There are very few treatments for it. And the pathophysiology was really interesting. It allowed me to learn a lot about secondary injury mechanisms and things of this nature.
So what is the prognosis for these patients who sustain major traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury? And then we can delve into the pathophysiology.
Sure. Well, it's varied depending on its mild, moderate, severe. So in traumatic brain injury, Glasgow Coma Scale, we can have very mild injuries such as concussion. We're studying that at the University of Miami. In terms of moderate and severe, basically it's measuring a lot of physiological markers of intracranial pressure and things like that, perfusion in the brain and things of this nature. And, you know, we have this lovely, you know, neuro ICU unit at University of Miami, where people are looking at new types of treatments and things like that early on in the injury cascade. In spinal cord injury, same thing. You have different ASIA scales of complete and non-complete, A through D. And again, it just depends on exactly the severity on what types of treatment you would get and what type of rehabilitation approaches, or do you need something like cell therapies and things of this nature to actually prepare the nervous system?
It's a great segue into the pathophysiology, both in terms of what happens in the short, medium, and long term. And, you know, what is the underlying mechanism for how this problem, the disease evolve.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's important to note that a lot of the secondary injury really makes a big difference in whether a patient has blasting deficit or how severe that deficit is. So the whole field is trying to understand how to target these various secondary injury mechanisms
So you say secondary injury. That means that the first injury is not necessarily the end of it all. There are other things that happen right after that first injury that can exacerbate the problem long term.
It's just the beginning of the story.
Wow.
In fact, we now talk about spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury as very progressive injuries. And if you follow these patients with MRI or other types of things, you can see that it's continually changing through their whole lives.
Well, just unveil the mystery right now. Why? How is it that it continues to evolve?
Well, you know, as you mentioned earlier, one of my focuses is on neuroinflammation.
And
that's one of the areas. Now,
how does that work?
Well, so if when I give a lecture to a medical students or whatever, graduate students, I always have a slide on pathophysiology and secondary injury mechanisms. And I make it as complicated as I can, because you cannot tell the story without the excitotoxicity, free radical generation, inflammation, all different types of cell signaling cascades that are activated with the initial trauma. So that's why it's been difficult to protect against these secondary injury mechanisms. And billions of dollars have been put into, you know, developing drugs that target one particular mechanism. But it's like, you've never heard my spider web lecture. I'm sure you have not. I haven't given it in many years. But it's like a spider web. You know, you've got the neuron in the middle. You've got all these different pathways that are trying to kill that cell. And you try to inhibit one pathway with a drug. It just kind of goes over because you have other pathways that would take over that.
Let me slow you down there, because, you know, I'm just a mere pediatric surgeon, not the scientist that you are. But
I don't need to slow down.
So you have all of these excitatory pathways that are activated. You said free radicals, all of these, they incite more inflammation. And that inflammation is going to cause a secondary injury. And what you're trying to do is figure out how to interrupt the progression of that cascade. Is that right?
That's correct.
For pediatric surgery.
That's correct. And so basically, how do you stop all of these parallel processes that are going on? First, you want to make sure that you can specialize medicine. Obviously, this is very important right now. So can you take a blood sample or a cerebral spinal fluid sample from a patient and determine what is the dominant injury cascade that patient at that time is having? And can you give something that will minimize that particular dominant pathway? So that's the way we're approaching it currently.
And you refer to the term inflammasome as a way of encapsulating all of these inflammatory pathways that lead to cell death after the injury.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, many, many years ago, a good friend of mine, Robert Keane, he's in the Department of Physiology here, walks into my office and goes, "Hey, Dalton, have you ever heard of the word inflammasome?" And I said something like, "Well, I think it's, you know, has to do with white blood cells, but it's really a nice name, Bob, you know." So basically, that started a really nice collaboration for many, many
years. One of our professors, brilliant professors of physiology.
Physiology, an outstanding artist as well, by the way.
Wow.
And so anyway.
And that's all part of that team science concept.
Yes, it is. So let me tell you, the inflammasome is a large multi-protein complex in the cytosol of cells. And what its job is to respond to stress, be it a bacteria or a virus or hypoxia or ischemia or trauma. So what the colleagues at the University of Miami have contributed to the inflammasome literature is that brain cells also have that innate immune machinery to respond to stress. And the other point that's important is very upstream. It's not downstream where we're talking about these pro-inflammatory cytokines that we've been trying to target with antibodies for many, many years. We're very, very upstream. So we're targeting that machinery that leads to the activation of these downstream and pro-inflammatory mediators.
So you're suggesting that that's the engine that activates the whole inflammatory cascade, that is more deleterious cytokine production, or I would say an exuberant inflammatory response, so to speak.
That's right. And it's the
inciter.
It's a very elegant machinery. It's got a sensor molecules and it's got adapter molecules. It's got a caspase 1 molecule that, when all this gets back activated, it leads to the cleavage of caspase 1, activation of IL-1 beta, IL-1 18. And then you start this process called pyroptosis, which is a brand new cell death mechanism that we, again, were the first to discover in the central nervous system. So that's the other problem that's challenging. You know, we used to think that cells after injury, a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, die by necrosis. They just fell apart, right? But now we're discovering there's a lot to program cell death mechanisms, where when you actually stress the brain, you have molecular pathways that are upregulated to actually kill a cell. And sometimes that's good, and sometimes, of course, after trauma, it's bad. So we have, that group has developed a series of antibodies to block inflammasome formation, and that is all intellectual property. It's been licensed by a company, and hopefully one day we'll actually put these antibodies into people.
So, just to dissect some of the dichotomy in the part. Inflammasome exists because it must have some protective effect. Mm-hmm. So you need some degree of inflammation. So, but there must be some imbalance so that when this catalyst is activated, if it's not controlled, then it leads to this exuberant inflammatory response. And that ultimately leads to cell death. Yeah. And all those neurodegenerative diseases that you've alluded to. So how do we know how to trigger just the right amount of inflammasome activation versus suppression?
We don't. So we measure, again, over an ICU, we're taking blood samples and CSF samples, and there's a level that we know is normal, which should be there, because as you just said, inflammation can have good, it's a double-edged sword, if you will. So it's there for a reason, but if it becomes uncontrolled and levels go too high, you know that that's going to be bad for the organ system, if you will.
And we don't know what triggers this inflammasome to just go haywire and just
It's probably cell-to-cell communication.
Right.
That, you know, you have one group of cells that are stressed, they upregulate this machinery, and they release, this is the other, you know, this might be a two-stage talk, but anyway, the cell itself.
And I love it. You get excited now.
The cell itself, this is great. This is what we're working on right now. The cell itself releases extracellular vesicles
What are those?
These are nanoparticles, nanomembrane-bound particles. But what's really cool about these exosomes and extracellular vesicles, they have the metabolic machinery, the genetic machinery that the cell itself has. So if the cell has too much inflammasome signaling, it packages the proteins, the lipids, and the genetic machinery that's released, and it goes to another cell. So this process can go on and on and on, and it can actually, these exosomes can get into the blood, travel to your lungs,
wow,
or your gut, and affect organ function, although the injury is primarily in the CNS. So that's
how brain injury could lead to systemic inflammation.
That's correct. So we write, for example, one of the big areas in neuroscience now is the brain-gut bidirectional axis, where when the brain is injured, it's releasing these factors in the blood that affect the gut microbiome. And then secondarily, the gut, and this is the brand new data,
wow,
that Dr. Nadine Courage has showed me, is that the gut manufactures these exosomes itself, and they go up and they affect the brain in terms of how it responds and its secondary injury mechanism. So isn't that really
that fascinating? Bidirectional mechanism?
Yeah.
So how does this lead to neurodegenerative diseases?
Okay, so we just got a nice grant looking at the importance of traumatic brain injury as a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
And it's allowing us to ask a question that we've, based on what we've been talking about for the last few minutes, is what's the role of abnormal inflammasome signaling in the ability of a previous concussion or TBI to affect long-term consequences of, and especially if a patient is walking around with particular genes that predispose he or she to Alzheimer's disease. What we're showing is that if you have a TBI, you have a rise in some of these pro-inflammatory cytokines and inflammasome signaling, but if you produce TBI in a mouse genetic model of AD, those levels are higher. So this seems to be an additive or a synergistic effect of this inflammasome process, and that's what we'll be studying for the next several years.
So I can't wait to have you back to tell us what you've discovered, because it sounds like it's going to be, a game changer for us if we can understand how this leads to Alzheimer's.
We can understand it, and then if we can actually protect against it.
Well, that's a great way to segue into the next part of this discussion. How do we modulate that response to either arrest or attenuate disease progression?
Okay. So when someone looks me up on PubMed, all of a sudden they see the word hypothermia and therapeutic hypothermia. I started working on that back in the mid-80s when we discovered that relatively small variations in brain temperature critically determine whether your CA1 hippocampus dies after cardiac arrest or not. So if you have if you artificially lower brain temperature by 1 or 2 degrees, you can protect against that pathology in a model of cardiac arrest. And if you raise it above normal thermia, you actually aggravate the pathology. And so,
why should a little change of 1 or 2 degrees Celsius change actually improve or augment the disease?
Does anybody want to know the answer to that question? They do. Okay, right. So it's because it affects all these secondary injury mechanisms we've talked about. Temperature, even a couple of degrees, affects the degree of excitotoxicity, free radical generation, and inflammation, which is including inflammasome signaling, which is one of the more potent effects of temperature modification. So we're really excited that over the years, this has moved into therapeutic hypothermia and targeted temperature management has now been used in cardiac arrest patients, term babies that have had some type of hypoxic insult and things like that. And these are relatively big success stories. So now we're trying to figure what patient population will benefit with neurotrauma.
Good. That was going to be my next question. It's what types of patient would benefit from this kind of intervention, and how soon after injury would you need to implement it to actually begin to notice or record some protective effect?
Yes. So my colleagues, Dr. Barth Green and Dr. Alan Levy, have always been very interested in using therapeutic hypothermia and temperature management in their spinal cord injury populations. So Alan currently has a multi-center trial from 6 sites. We were recruiting patients to cool them down as soon as we can. Okay, so what is the therapeutic window for therapeutic hypothermia and severe TBI? We don't know. So basically, we're trying to cool within 6 hours if we can get the patient stabilized and start cooling.
Is that one of the interventions in the multi-institutional trial?
Yeah, that's it. It's all hypothermia. So we cool and we use these intravascular catheter cooling devices that we can just type in the temperature of the patient. So we bring the patient down to about 34 degrees. We don't want to go any lower because of some of the effects on cardiac function, but we leave the temperature down for 2 days. And then over the third day, we slowly rewarm that patient. And that's all based on work we did in the laboratory. And so far, the safety monitoring board says we're not hurting anyone. And preliminary data from our own UM site shows we may be converting Asia A's, worst case scenario, to Asia B's and C's, 6 months out. So
are you also monitoring some of the inflammatory markers? Do we see any change in some of those?
We're not right now looking at that because we wanted to get the trial started, because it's a multi-center trial, that would have been a little bit complex step, but we're doing that in patients in the ICU right now with severe TBI, for example, and utilizing those types of manipulations. So therapeutic hypothermia, to answer your question, may be one way, and then of course antibodies, they may target directly the inflammasome, might be another way, or people are developing new compounds all the time that target inflammation, for example.
This is not going to have any impact on the patients who go on to have Alzheimer's disease, I guess.
Well, maybe if you reduce the inflammation or attenuate the amount of damage in the TBI, that could then potentially affect if what we're saying is true, that TBI is a major clinically relevant risk factor for Alzheimer's maiden stuff.
So as we continue to talk about the link between neuroinflammation and neurodegenerative diseases, I'm reminded of the CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, that people in sports and football in particular has been the major culprit go on to develop. So this is you're postulating based on your work that this would be the same pathway, inflammation, further cell death, and that leads to this chronic problem. So you could potentially have an answer for that too, huh?
We think so. So we've been using the University of Miami Alzheimer's Brain Bank to actually look at human tissue. And we've looked at inflammasome signaling in those human brains, not with TBI, but with Alzheimer's. And we've seen evidence for increased inflammasome signaling, ASC, which is this adaptor molecule, being associated with the plaques and some of the more classic A-beta accumulation that we see in the folded proteins in the brain. So those papers have been published. This is work by Regina Botel, who's in the Department of Neurology. And we're trying now, Dean Ford, to answer your question. Can we show the same thing in these patients with chronic traumatic encephalopathy? So I'm interacting with the individual at Boston College who has this very large human collection of CTE patients. And hopefully we can get those particular sections down and stain them and answer your question. So that's what we're going to do in the process.
Truly fascinating. Now, all of this great work, this fascinating work that we can don't talk about for another hour, is taking place under the auspices of Miami Project. I know it's team science, but that's really where all of this fantastic work has been taking place, and you've been driving excellence in research there for quite some time. Tell us a little bit about some of the major contributions of the Miami Project to the field in general, and also how the Burnett County Foundation has really been a major source of support and the driver for the research behind this.
So you're right. A lot of this has been initiated by Miami Project faculty, but the most important thing that I have to say is that everything I've talked about is also the work is occurring in other different types of departments. Department of Psychiatry, for example, with David Lowenstein, others, and then neurology, for example, with Regina. And we're working really closely now with James Galvin, for example, in neurology, and also the Parkinson group as well. So we kind of work with all different types and basic science departments as well, for example. What I think in terms of the project, what I'm really most proud of over these years is the ability to bring in some really outstanding scientists that want to collaborate and do team science and work together for this bigger cause in terms of changing medicine, if you will. And what we've done is develop a therapeutic pipeline where a basic scientist can discover something in an animal model, for example, move that to a translational phase, and then ultimately be able to talk to clinicians and get them excited about what we're doing in the laboratory. So that's what's very unique, I think, at the University of Miami, that we can go to grand rounds, we can present, we can get residents, we can get faculty excited about what we're doing, and before we know it, we're submitting grants and things of this nature. The Boni Cani Fund has been extremely important to, I think, the University of Miami and the Miami Project, because it's provided funds that have allowed us to buy the equipment we need to recruit new scientists and things like that. As you know, the project was started in 1985 with the vision by Barth Green that they were going to bring all the great scientists of the world together and cure paralysis following spinal cord injury. I was very fortunate in 1981. I was in the Parkinson building, and neurology and neurosurgery were in that building. So I met Dr. Green very early prior to the Miami Project, but even at that early stage, he was telling me about this vision. So I had the opportunity to watch the project grow for many, many years and became associated with it in 1997. So I think the Miami Project, the Boni Cani Fund, is a really special team. And Mark Boni Cani, before that, Nick Boni Cani, of course, are very susceptible to thinking out of the box, that what you learn in spinal cord injury can benefit potentially traumatic brain injury and concussion, and now even neurodegenerative diseases. So I think that's what's special about the programs.
Yeah, that's really great. And there couldn't have been a better leader for the project than you, especially because of your philosophical embrace of team science, because that's how you are really advancing the field and bringing everybody together. So
thank you very much.
It has been just an exciting 30 minutes. I can't believe the time is already up. We've touched on some critical topics, and it is my hope that you're going to come back and expand a little bit more, especially as the results of this the hypothermia trial become available.
Well, thank you, Dean Ford. Thank you very much for this invitation. I've enjoyed it as well.
Thank you, sir, very much. And this has been another exciting episode of Inside UMiami Medicine with our guest, Dr. Dietrich, the brilliant scientist, leads the Miami Project, and so many other great things. A real prophet in many ways for team science. So thank you, and we look forward to you joining us again on another podcast. Thank you.